My talk is generally about different models of multiprocessor computation. In particular, though, I'm going to talk a little bit more particularly about the type of work that we're doing at SGI, which is really around scalable shared memory multiprocessing, sort of a new model, if you will, and what we call S2MP, which is the SGI's architecture for this. So to give you an idea of the talk here, first I'm going to talk about the different choices for high-performance computing, and then in particular about the SMP shared memory multiprocessing model and how we scale it, and then in particular give you an idea of our Origin system, which is the first of this sort of class that SGI has produced, and then some of the future trends in HPC and how that factors into this. So in terms of what you have today, obviously traditionally when people think high performance computing, they really think of parallel vector processors, PVPs, Cray's if you will, which obviously since the merger of SGI and Cray seems a lot better to us now. but obviously parallel vector processors consist of a set of vector processors on the small number, usually 16 to 32, connected through a global switch to multiple banks of main memory. I think people are familiar with this. Obviously, that sort of got attacked originally by the growth of microprocessors and the MPP sort of architectures, where we've set up separate nodes that sort of act like individual computers, had a high-performance network interface, and then a global switch to connect these, either a mesh or a hypercube, if you will. So I'm sure people are familiar with that. And then obviously, this has evolved into a sort of today's cluster sort of arrangements that you see. Basically, the problem with the MPP being that it was very special purpose, could only be really exploited by people who wanted to solve large problems. So economically, it wasn't all that viable. So there really isn't many of the MPP systems left on the market. But clusters have become very popular. Because clusters at their heart are basically standalone high-volume machines for which you've augmented them with a network interface somewhere in the I/O subsystem out to a global switch and can connect these together. And obviously, again, the same sort of global switch networks that you have for the MPPs. Now, the one issue, though, is that you still are talking about a message-passing programming paradigm for this machine. And obviously, the fact that things live off the network interface, off of the I/O for the network, make the intercommunication even more expensive than it would be in a MPP machine. And then the fourth type that SGI has been known for a number of years has been the SMP architecture, where you put a number of processors on a big central bus, a gigabyte per second bus, connected to memory and I/O. And the key here has been that there's a bus here, and this bus allows for shared memory and high-speed communication between the processors and allows you to build a big machine with a lot of central resource, a lot of big I/O capability in it. But the other problem has been that this bus has been a limit in how big you could build these systems. You basically have baked in the maximum size based on the amount of bandwidth you build in here, and you've also baked in a cost such that you cannot drive this to a low price point. So what you really would like to do is combine all these together, right? To have the shared memory programming model and close coupling that you get in either a RISC SMP or a PVP, to get the scaling of a message passing machine, and to get the economics of a workstation cluster so that it's a high volume. And in that, you get what I call a scalable SMP, or SSMP. So how do you do that? How have we done this, actually? Well, the first step is, if you go back to the central bus, is obviously I've said the bus is the problem. You got to get rid of the bus. So what do you replace it with? Well, you're going to replace it with a switch. So it's a same type of switch as you would see in a MPP, if you will, would work here. It obviously has to be very high performance in terms of high bandwidth and low latency. But by going to a switch, you can build this switch small to build small systems and grow it larger to scale the bandwidth for large systems. Now, the other thing you have to do when you switch this around is On the old slide, I had Snoopy caches. Basically, the caches provide high performance. Obviously, almost all microprocessors or all microprocessors use cache memory, and the Snoopy caches were keeping those memories coherent, those caches coherent. If you remove the bus, those schemes fall away, and you have to move to what's called directory-based cache coherence. And in directory-based cache coherence, you've basically moved the smarts for the caching down into the memory system. The memory knows who has cached a particular block of memory, and when that needs to be invalidated due to somebody writing to it, or if a cache has the most up-to-date copy when you read it, the directory knows how to steer you to that particular processor, and it removes essentially the need for broadcast, and thus the need to have a bus, or to, if you tried to remove the bus and didn't have directories, you'd saturate the switch. So really the key here is putting a switch network and having these directories to support cache coherence, and all of a sudden you have a scalable SMP. But if you stopped here, you really haven't recognized all the gain, because you'd still have this very specialized machine with a big switch in the middle and a box that's oriented around a central resource. So what you want to do is push the memory and the I/O resources through the switch. And when you do that, you end up with what we call DSM, distributed shared memory. And it's not, it looks like a distributed memory machine, if you will, if you cut it off here. It looks just like your cluster, if you will, or maybe more like your MPP, but it has basically this one extra interface in the local processing node that allows you to get to the global switch and talk to every other part of the system in terms of its memory. And we still have the directory, so the important thing here is that while we've modularized the system, all memory is still accessible and cacheable by every processor, and all I/O can both be accessible to every processor, as shown here, and can DMA into all of the memories. So the actual architecture that we're talking about is still shared memory, still the same as if you had this central bus, but we've now made the bus scalable, and we've made it distributed in order to make the system more modular and basically very scaling in its cost as well as its performance. Okay, so you can say, well, that's all great. You know, if this has been true, why haven't we done this before? You know, what's new about this? Well, basically, you couldn't build this system before. Until today's technology, essentially, until we got to sort of half micron CMOS with a million gate ASICs and so forth. Before then, things like a central bus was faster than any switch network we could build or cost-effectively build, and we'd have to build it out of, you know, gas or something more exotic. So the fact that we have this high integration level and high performance CMOS really makes a difference. Another key technology that has just been developed in the last few years essentially is very high speed link and switch technology, so we can replace this bus. The link in the system I'm going to talk about in a few minutes here runs at 400 megahertz over 16-bit wide data, so it's 800 megabytes per second sort of individual links, and then you put numbers of these together to build the switch network. Another sort of new technology that didn't exist until recently has been this whole directory-based cache coherence I mentioned is in itself a new idea. Basically, you know, directory-based cache coherence schemes like this, where you've put the smarts in the memory and you have the state machines that know how to really interact with all the caches, that work really has only been around since the late, those concepts really have only been around since the late 80s. And practical research machines really only came online since basically in the last 5 years. So that's another new technology. And the other thing that goes along with that sort of complexity being able to be enabled into hardware has been the development of new techniques. There's a lot of new formal methods that we're using to develop these machines that allow us to really, you know, say that a large collection of directories and memories, processors interacting in a distributed way, actually properly executes this cache coherence protocol. So new development techniques have really come online. So in building a scalable SMP, and when you look at the structure I've shown, there's really a question of, well, what's different between that and a distributed memory machine, you know, your CM5s or other people or other distributed machines that have been around for a while. Well, really the difference, the fundamental difference is the fact that you can cache remote memory and access it and cache it directly. You don't have to pass messages back and forth to the other nodes. And how effectively you can use that, I mean, you can always program these machines like memory, distributed memory machines. There's nothing to prevent you from doing that. But if you're really going to use the shared memory, how are you going to get at it? How effective is it? Well, basically, if there's high latency and low bandwidth to the remote memory, well, then obviously you're going to have to be careful about every access you make to that remote memory. And it really is going to have to be programmed and function like a distributed memory machine. If the latency is low and the bandwidth is high to the remote memory, then optimizing for the difference between your local node accesses and memory and inter-node accesses is more of an optimization. Obviously, if you're trying to eke out that last bit of performance, it's going to matter to you, and you're going to try and do that. But if you're just interested in getting your code up and running, or just, you know, getting your answer, and the actual efficiency isn't as important, you can ignore that. Let me give you an example of how that really works. Here's a diagram that sort of says what happens to your CPU efficiency depending upon a number of factors. This is relative efficiency. So I'm assuming in this is just a made-up example, that your CPU is stalled on memory misses, cache misses, 25% of the time. And if you have some percentage of accesses to your local memory, you know, the memory that's in the same node as the processor making the reference, versus remote memory, that's the bottom axis. So that's, you know, how much what percent is here for this processor or this one versus all the rest, all the other memories. That's this ratio here. And then the parameterized factor here is what's the ratio of latency to local memory to remote memory. And, you know, in message passing machines, these ratios tend to be, you know, probably on the order of 100 to 1, right? You could talk to your local memory at least 100 times faster than you can send a message to your neighbor and get a result, get an answer back. Well, in distributed shared memory, that usually goes down, but in some machines, it's still 10 times local memory. And you can see here, if you never reference remote memory, you're fine. But as you reference it more and more, if you treat it as a shared memory resource and don't care about it at all, obviously you can end up all the way at zero. You know, that local, the odds that you're local in a large machine could asymptotically go to zero. And obviously this machine performance falls from, you know, 100% efficiency down to 30%. Well, you know, that's not going to be interesting. You're going to want to drive this number to something reasonable in terms of efficiency, or just you're going to change your programming paradigm to move down this axis here towards more accesses being local. And we found that in many applications, without really any work at all, you end up at about this point, this 50% point is local, just because there's stack references, all sorts of things that are local to a particular process versus the shared accesses. But again, it's key here, even at 10x, obviously you're down here to 45% efficiency. If you're 5x, you're still just a little over 65. But now when you start getting in this range, you know, ratio of 3 to 1 or better, obviously you're seeing here you're upwards of 80% efficient, and you're starting to get to the range where, you know, you're going to use this machine as shared memory, and you're not going to worry about that loss efficiency because, you know, you want to get your job done, not necessarily spend all your time just programming the machine. Similar effect on remote bandwidth. If you don't, obviously you want to get, this has a lot of percentages on it, this chart, but if you were using up, again, for the same example, if you were using up 40% of your bandwidth to remote memory, and again, you have some amount of degree of locality, and these axes have to do with, well, if I had the same amount of bandwidth to remote memory as local, well, then obviously it doesn't matter how much is local and how much is remote. That utilization is still 40% of your memory bandwidth. As the ratio of remote bandwidth goes down, and up here we're talking about this is anywhere from 100% to 3/4 to 50% to 1/4 or 1/8, the ratio between local and remote, then obviously the more remote you access, meaning the less local, the higher utilization you get up to, and obviously this results in queuing and further delays, further increases in latency up to the point, you know, obviously if you only have 1/8 as much remote bandwidth, if you access that very frequently, you're going to saturate that memory and you just won't the problem won't scale. So again, you have to keep the ratio of remote bandwidth to local bandwidth close to 1-to-1, or many applications won't be able to use this as a real shared memory machine. They're going to have to use it as a distributed machine where you keep all the references, the percentage of references that are local very much skewed towards 100%. So, you know, obviously, you know, as a lead up, when we went around to design our new Origin machines, we really tried hard to keep those ratios, to keep the local to remote latencies very close to, you know, 2-to-1 or less, and to keep the remote bandwidth very high to memory. So this is a picture, if you will, of our of some of the new machines that we've come out with in the last year. This is the Origin 2000 desk side, and then there's a rack mount version, and then there's also an entry-level Origin 200, which really, they all have the same distributed shared memory architecture. This one in a slightly different package. These ones actually, if you can kind of notice, it's really the same desktop module, just racked into a rack. So let me give you a little more details on this. Basically what we've done here is create a system based on what we call node boards, and a node board consists of a single chip, you know, again, high integration level hub chip, we call it. It basically has all the smarts of the distributed shared memory. It interfaces to high speed, it's like 800 megabyte per second local memory with the directory here, shared by two processors. These are R10,000 processors, peak floating point, you know, like 400 megaflops. And out of this hub, you see an I/O interface, a high-speed I/O interface, and then a high-speed link out to the other nodes. And we build the switch network I'll talk about in a second. Architecturally, the machine can actually go up to 1,000 processors or 512 of these nodes. For various business reasons, we're really commercializing that up to 64 nodes or 128 processors. This is what one actually looks like. This is a node board. Here's the hub chip. The processors here and their caches are here. This is the main memory. You can put up to 4 gigabytes of memory on each node, or up to 64 gigabytes of memory in 128 processors. This here actually is what we call the extended directory. When you get to a certain point, since the directory is keeping track of things on a per processor basis, we've optimized this to have some of the base directory up to 32 processors embedded on these DIMMs, the main memory DIMMs, and then these supplemental ones take it up to 128, or actually 1,024. And as I mentioned, there's very high speed links. These 400 megahertz links, they're running out the back here through this, what's called a CPOP. It's actually a pad-on-pad compression dendritic connection that basically provides a matched impedance through the board, through the midpoint and so forth. So what are some of the things that we've had to worry about here in this design? Basically, on the processors, obviously, you need a processor with high performance. If you know, it's real hard to gang up a bunch of very low performance processors to really get aggregate high performance on anything that you know you're trying to solve one problem with. Obviously, it has to be high integration level. Another key for supporting shared memory is you need a 64-bit architecture. 64-bit operating system and processor architecture, and a lot of physical address bits. This machine actually, in the 1024, could actually support a terabyte of physical memory. So that's 40 bits. And of course, for I/O accessibility, you need more than 40 bits. And another important thing is that since the processor is using memory transactions to communicate back and forth, it's important that the processor have a very intelligent, non-blocking memory interface that allows multiple outstanding transactions. And the R10,000 processor that we use, the MIPS R10,000, does this. This is a very simple example showing many architectures, and things are evolving, but many machines you see today, if it has a cache miss, it'll just stall until that's resolved, then maybe execute for a little while, then cache miss again. And what you can do on the R10,000, assuming you can compute the address ahead of time, so it's some sort of array indices or some other independent access, not chasing down a linked list, that you can get these misses going in parallel. And obviously, you know, if your code is dominated by cache misses, this is going to have a tremendous effect on the throughput. And of course, one thing that DSM really enables is it gives you that amount of bandwidth per processor to really support this kind of intense memory activity. The other thing we've done here is in integrating the hub chip, this single node, if you will, here's a one node and another node, is that we have a crossbar at the center here. And in terms of the remote bandwidth issue that I raised a little bit ago, you can be accessing, because there's a crossbar in the middle, you can be accessing another node's memory while he's accessing your memory without any degradation in throughput, because they're two totally independent paths. And that's in contrast to a structure that is used on some of the other machines that are trying to do distributed shared memory, where you have a bus, and then off that bus hangs this magic interface to the rest of the world. As you can imagine here, since you're if you try and access the other memory, and the other processor is accessing your memory, well, this bus gets overutilized. Even if these links are full duplex, the bus is not, and thus the best you're going to do on this is half the bandwidth that you could get to local memory, to remote memory, and typically it's going to be more like a third. By integrating it down like this as well, we're also achieving very low latency, which I'll show in a little bit, because you're only going through two chips to get to remote memory versus, you know, obviously in this case, you're probably going through a bus interface chip, another chip here, and then, you know, the similar on this side, you're going to hit four, you know, basically four chips on your way to memory at least. Okay. How about the interconnect? Obviously, if you're going to really treat this machine as a shared memory machine, you have to worry about high bandwidth to all the memory. And obviously, folks are aware probably here of different dimensions of interconnect that you can get. Obviously, a bus may be a 0D interconnect, a ring is a 1D. 2D and 3D grids are very popular. And then there's the hypercube that was popular and has somewhat fallen off. And the question is, what did we want to implement? Well, for a number of reasons, we really were going after something that, one, distributed, and two, linearly increases the bisection bandwidth, meaning the bandwidth in the middle of the machine linearly with the growth in processors. And really the only one that does that is the hypercube. So that's actually what we've implemented. So we have a system that starts, again, if you just have these two hubs, if there's just four processors, they talk directly to one another, and there's really no network. As that grows up to 16 processors, you have a 2D network. When it goes to 32, you have a 3D network. When it goes to 64, it's a 4D network. Now, one issue you get with a hypercube, another downside is that you always, to double the size of the system, you need another port on every one of your routers. Well, the best we could do in the technology, the half-micron CMOS we're using was six ports per router. So you have to solve that problem somehow. And what we've done is actually go to what's called a fat hypercube. So we have a second level of hypercube connecting the sixth port out to a second level of cubes. But what we've done in making it fat is we've actually do eight networks in parallel. Since there's eight routers down here, we have eight networks in parallel. And by doing that, again, we can keep the bisection bandwidth growing linearly with the number of processors in the system. So you see here, this is the 128 processor system where there's eight of these, but to do that second level in this system, you only need one router, right? A single router can handle four ports. So that gets you to 128. If this wanted to grow to 1024, you'd simply take this individual point and grow it to a 2D, 3D, up to a 5D cube, and you'd have eight of those in parallel, and that would be your 1024 processor. Again, giving you guys some idea on the physical. That's what one of these, again, we built it very modular, so on a single board is a router. It's got its six ports, three that go out to cabled links, and three that go in internally, two to individual nodes and one to its corresponding router. So you get in each box I showed earlier, you get eight processors, which is an edge of a hypercube. Probably running a little short on time, but just to give you an idea, some of the work that really led away from hypercubes was this work by Bill Daly and Chuck Seitz at Caltech, where they were really showing that for the parameters of the time, you really had these, you were really trading off serial hypercube links versus parallel mesh links. And given that, they showed that even out to a million nodes, this red line, that the optimal dimension was something 5. So a low dimensional network made the most sense. But reality In today's technology, what you're really doing is starting with a link that you can develop, the fastest link, which in our case was a 16-bit link running at 400 megahertz, 800 megabytes per second. And if you plug that kind of parameter in and you figure out what you can build, the curves look like this, meaning that higher dimensional networks always make more sense. And that's really what drove us to this hierarchical hypercube. And the resulting data is this. This is what we achieve in terms of cache miss latencies. You can see here for two processors, which really means everything is local, we're down here at about just over 300 nanoseconds for a cache miss. If you go to four, so that you have half local, half remote, that only goes up to about 400, because basically the closest remote you can get to is 500, about 540 nanoseconds away. And then that grows very slowly because we're using the hypercube, so you can always get to twice as many places with only one more step. So you can see the average here grows very slowly, and even in the 1024 case, it is slight. I think this is this is the pure hypercube. So if we had all the dimensions in a particular router that we wanted, the green line here, I think this is still staying about a microsecond. And the blue line, the hierarchical hypercube, we take a little jump up to go to that second level and come back. And you see here it becomes it's less than 1.2 microseconds. Now, if we had done a mesh, you can see at higher dimensions, you really take off because you have a lot of hops to get there. And similarly, on bisection bandwidth, that's where it makes it even more important at low dimensions. You can see here that the mesh is only growing slowly, whereas the hypercube and the fat hypercube grow linearly with the number of processors that you have. How about I/O? One of the advantages of a big central machine is a big central I/O capability. And again, to exploit the switch nature of the machine, we built a switch-based I/O subsystem. So we have a crossbar that attaches to two nodes and then fans out the same sort of high-speed links that we use between nodes to I/O devices. And really what we've done for the various high performance, you know, this is SGI, so we always have very high performance graphics capabilities. Those communicate directly with the same sort of 1.6 gigabyte per second link, you know, 800 megabytes times two because it's full duplex. For lower bandwidth needs and just more common interconnect, we go through a PCI bridge to PCI buses. And these obviously don't need the full 1.6. There's also support for VME. But the real difference in this system is when you're talking about I/O cards, what you plug in typically is a card like this. Now, this is the bridge right on it here, the PCI to XIO bridge. And then off here is basically the whole, this is the logic for a serial hippie card. And this card basically is capable of close to 100 megabytes per second full duplex. But what you're really doing is you're adding a whole PCI bus at a time when you add this capability versus other machines where you're typically adding a PCI card at a time out on this bus. You're adding a whole new PCI bus at a time. So there's very high performance I/O in the machine. This is just to give you an idea. This is what the midpoint of the machine looks like. You know, here's the two crossbars, and then there's 12 I/O slots and four processor slots and two router slots in there. In terms of packaging, again, I sort of pointed this out, the desk side is this modular packaging where you can plug in four node boards for eight processors and the 12 IOs into the midplane. That's what the backside of one of them looks like in place. And to give you some perspective, and I guess since this is Germany, I figured I'd put that out there for the front side. But the router cards plug into the front here along with disk and power supply and so forth. The smaller system, the Origin 200, basically what we've done with that is simply put one node in one box and then pull out that crossbar for the I/O. So you go directly to the bridge and the PCI, so you can actually expand this with PCI cards, and it has a number of disks. It's sort of an optimized for an entry level. But even in that system, what you can do is use the CradeLink interconnect out at the back, so you can put two of these modules together to get up to four processors. And if you're intending to go beyond four processors, you tend to buy the bigger box to start with. and then you can grow that box up to the, in a rack, you have 16 processors and a 2D mesh, 2D mesh, and for two racks, that's 32, and then you can grow that up to multi-racks for for the 128. So that's the actual concept of distributed shared memory and our implementation of it. I guess the interesting question, or the more general question for this audience is, well, where is technology leading us to? You know, is this really the right thing, or is this just another aberration? And what I'd like to argue is that this really is the future of computing, in a sense that CPU processing rates continue to go up at a very steady pace, and that implies that memory performance, I'm sure you've seen in a lot of your applications, your memory performance can be your performance in many of these machines. So you have to push the lower latency of the memory and higher bandwidth. In addition, if you look at the trends, you know, density is keeping steadily improving, and you got to figure out what you're going to do with that amount of processing power. Well, generally, you're going to want eventually to move CPU to control directly the memory, not through any ASIC at all. And eventually, if you look at the work at Berkeley and so forth, you're going to put the DRAM right on the same silicon as the processing. So you're going to go to this distributed memory concept. And also, of course, obviously, the economics imply that really the winner in the end is high volume replicated nodes that you can build small machines out of, because that's the dominant part of the marketplace anyways, and then grow to large machines as needed. So what does that really say? Well, traditional SMP machines aren't really very effective at any of these. Their latency and bandwidth is poor. They're not really set up for integrated CPUs, and their cost economies are marginal. Parallel vector processors have sort of a similar stack up. MPP systems, obviously are okay in latency and bandwidth because, you know, you can only get at local memory, and they could become fully integrated. But, you know, building special purpose large machines only doesn't make sense. But what does make sense? Well, cluster machines make sense. Obviously, you know, if you just talk about single processors or small number of processors, you can improve on CPU latency and bandwidth on integration and follow the cost economics. And since the scalable SMP also scales down to be small, right, you really can sell people, and people can effectively use 2 to 4 processors or 2 to 8 processors, the volumes are reasonable here. So what has that led us to do at SGI Cray? Really, we've announced publicly already this map of where we are today. Obviously, these are the products we have in the high-performance space today with the Origin, T3E, J90, T90. We obviously have some speed bumps of those coming, but not in the not-too-distant future, we'll be merging those product lines together in what we call SN1. This is what we call SN0 sometimes. And, you know, obviously the vector processing for what vectors do well can still, you know, provide a function that you can't get even probably in our next generation, but the one after that, heading towards the year 2000, we'll be merging that as well. So you say, okay, well, that's interesting. Well, what's really going to win, clusters or the scalable SMP? Let's think about that. Clusters, obviously, are the highest volume probably you're going to get, because obviously you can take any workstation and just throw 100 base T at it and say, well, there's my cluster. And obviously that technology is relatively cheap. Fault isolation is also good on these machines because you're running independent machines. And obviously it can be heterogeneous if you want it to be. The advantage of the scalable SMP is really the fact that it's much more tightly coupled. So if you're really trying to run a parallel job and program it reasonably, you can use this SSMP much better. You also have shared resources that you can't get typically in cluster machines. You really can get these very high bandwidth pipes in and out of an SSMP that you can't find in a cluster. And obviously, if you have too big of a cluster running around, administration becomes a real headache. Obviously, the smaller number of large machines, administration is a lot more reasonable. And in terms of fault isolation and such, because of the modularity of these type of systems, as I've shown you, there's no reason why you can't get fault isolation. And because of the reasonable volumes, you can approach at least the same sort of economics that you see in a cluster. And what we've done in our origin really to address that is really build in a lot of availability features. You know, obviously you do the normal things, ECC and high integration. But beyond that, and the fact that it's modular at its nature obviously helps you, but beyond that, we really have, one of the other reasons with going with the hypercube is that it naturally provides you multiple paths between any two points in the system. And second of all, because we're pushing the high-speed link technology and actually taking our, what we used to, you know, think of as our bread and butter, that bus that we protected inside the system, outside the system, we put hardware CRC error checking and retry in the links themselves and made that transparent. So any kind of transient errors are also covered. In addition, of course, the major problem you end up with is the operating system. If you have one copy of the operating system and something goes wrong, well, obviously that's probably going to be your most bit of failure. Well, how can we deal with that? Well, basically at a hardware level, and I don't really have time to get into all the software issues, but at the hardware level, we really have all the mechanisms in place to fully control the sharing that goes on, even at the kernel level, so that a particular node can, on a per 4 kilobyte page, protect itself from every other node and only open up certain pages for communication. And this is really the basis for both doing clusters inside an individual system, as well as we move forward, providing more and more single system image and shared memory support in a way in which the operating system, a panic of a particular node doesn't result in a panic of the entire system. But clusters do make sense as well. We've had a cluster project for a while now, and we continue to believe that that makes sense for a number of people. Today we have the obviously the basic high-speed communication protocol communication networks available, including, like I said, this HIPPI. Our HIPPI interface is very high performance. By the end of this year, we'll also add 1000 base T and support for, as I mentioned, doing arrays within a single origin system. We're also sort of at the forefront of what we call HIPPI 6400, which will basically take HIPPI up to close to the gigabyte per second range. And that'll be available at the end of 1998. Maybe I have one more slide on this in particular. How have we really done this? Basically, we've leveraged the technology that we had for an individual link inside our origin system to work as a network. And what did that really take? Well, one thing is that we had to basically do AC encoding because it's not in a single ground domain anymore. It's across systems. And because we want to support both long copper and optical links, we have a de-skew at the interface capability to take the 16 bits and skew them back. And in terms of the way we present it to the user, it's still sort of a HIPPI compatible network layer. But you can, out of this, build a network that has 800 megabyte per second full duplex bandwidth into each host, have latencies that are 10 microseconds or below, and have links that are up to a kilometer. And obviously, for the kind of things that you guys do with your big colliders and other experiments, this sort of technology I think will be very applicable. So what do we see as the real answer here? Well, the real answer, we believe, is clusters of these SMP systems. Basically, you'll build the shared memory systems up to the size that your largest parallel job wants, where you really need that tight coupling, and also up to the largest size for which your resource sharing makes sense. If you have a huge I/O pipe that you need to feed into a machine, you're going to need to basically build a decent-sized machine behind that so that your parallel jobs can get at that I/O resource. And obviously, you're going to do that to the point where you've reduced your administrative costs, so you're not running around with thousands of workstations that you're trying to administer. But you'll also use cluster machines, and you'll use those down to the size where you get your either if you're doing one single job, your communication either to your I/O or between CPUs is limited enough that you can get enough bandwidth. Or you'll use clusters when the physical distance between the machines are large. Or you'll use it when you're in a heterogeneous environment. And generally, where that boundary is between people who will cluster and people who will use scalable SMP will vary quite a bit. Obviously, if you're doing total throughput sort of jobs, maybe as low as 2 to 4 processors might make sense. And if you're doing very large-scale jobs, like some of the ASCII program that we're involved with Los Alamos, you'll build a single shared memory machine up to the thousands of processor range. So that's what we see as a future, clusters of SSMP. Thank you.